Today's program was brought to you by Catskill Provisions. Located in a small corner of Northwest Catskill Mountains, they specialize in creating raw, all-natural, handmade food products. For more information, visit CatskillProvisions.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with the lovely Aida Mollenkamp.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. You were someone that I knew but didn't know since 2005.
Right.
We both, not collaborated, but worked together at Chow. And ever since then, I've been seeing what you've done, your work. And this is just such a cool time to have you on because Keys to the Kitchen is such a wonderful culmination of your past education, your foils, and,
Thank you.
Yeah. So it must be pretty cool to have this finally out.
Yeah, it is. I worked in media since basically then, since 2005, and I felt really fortunate to be at Chow. And I think what really stayed with me from there is that concept that there's a lot of people who know how to eat well, but don't necessarily know how to reproduce it themselves. And I took that, kind of ran with it, and that became Keys to the Kitchen. So it's been 2 years, and now it's out, and it's still surreal. So yeah. It shows up at, I don't know, my friend's apartments, or they call me, Instagram it, and I'm still like, wait, that's a book I created. Yeah, yeah.
It's not just a book. I mean, it's a biblical proportions. I mean, this is something
I don't know about biblical proportions.
Well, maybe those
Michael.
Small little Gideon's ones that they put in the hotel.
I'll take it. But Motel, I mean, six levels.
Exactly. Yeah. The super eights. But it is something that isn't a single point of view. I mean, it is a bookends kind of book with so many facets to it, tips, techniques, ethnicities, such as yourself. Not that Mollenkamp is a multi-ethnic name.
No, it's not.
What kind of name is that anyway? What's your heritage?
I don't know. Drunk Irish people?
Just another mutt.
No, I kind of know. That's not true. Okay. So I'm just like my name. My first name, Aida, is Italian, and I am 50% Italian. And then I'm 50% Mollenkamp. What Mollenkamp is debated. Somebody told me it's Prussian. I don't know. Yeah. Dutch. I like Dutch. And when I'll tell you this, when I show up in Amsterdam, everybody speaks to me in Dutch. So yeah. I'll take that. And that's what I'm going to go with.
Excellent. And your family, did they cook traditionally Italian food growing up, or did they cook Prussian?
Yeah, they cooked extensive Prussian food. So my dad is like meat and potatoes, Northern Ohio guy. So my dad specializes in beef stroganoff, which is why I have a meatless version of it.
On the spaghetti? Don't they do like the chili sauce on the spaghetti too?
Oh, that's Cincinnati. We're not from Cincinnati. Yeah. So I've never actually had that. I think that's Michael Ruhlman would be able to talk to you about that. Then my mom is from a town that seems like it's out of some mid-century movie about steel mills. Like, it's a steel mill town on the Ohio River, and it's, you're either Greek or Italian, absolutely nothing else. So we grew up cooking Greek and Italian food, and that's kind of what I was. I don't know, I was fortunate, I had a family that cooked.
Yeah.
And I have a stepmother who is from northern France, and she taught me my first souffle and potato leek soup.
Yeah.
At 12 years old. So
that's your Francophile self, because after going to school, you went to Cornell, the hotel management. That experience, what is that like? Does that feel more business oriented than it does cooking?
The program was going through a transition. I was there in the, at the turn of the millennium, and it really was transitioning at that moment. And so I kind of kept going back and forth, and I like kept one foot in real estate and finance, and I kept one foot in operations. And so you have to work about 1,000 hours or something before you can graduate. And I kept going back and forth between working in kitchens and working at like consulting firms and stuff like that. So think of it like a really great undergrad grad economics program, but instead of studying widgets, you're studying things like food costs and how to run a hotel.
Well, I mean, which is super necessary because a lot of people go the chef route without ever realizing that they have to deal with numbers afterwards.
Yeah. And I think what it really gave me personally was you're exercising right and left brain the whole time that you're doing a program like that. And I wanted that in my job. And so I think that's eventually why I ended up in media as opposed to staying in the, you know, in the actual service side of the industry.
I mean, asking these questions, I'm seeing more and more how this book became what it is and how it's composed because in Keys to the Kitchen, you even talk about sanitation. I mean, the organization is very logistical, is very managerial.
So, okay, you should know that when I was at real estate, I don't know, finance, consulting, whatever the heck that job was, I used to be the person who would build those extensive Excel models. So I'm really skilled at making formulas, which is why I base the whole book on a formula. Excellent. You know,
you should talk to Scott, the Seattle Food Geek. Yes. He actually worked on Excel. He helped build that with Microsoft.
I didn't know that. We were talking too. That's funny. I didn't know that. We're going to have a whole Excel conversation.
Yeah, don't have that on air. Well, I mean, maybe we'll find a whole other demographic.
No, it's really not that exciting. But, you know, that I think that gave me the structure for the book because I said when I so when I was at Chow, Chronicle is actually down the street, seriously, two blocks down. And I felt they were my dream publisher. They're the biggest independent publisher in the nation. And, you know, they care about graphic design. They care about absolutely, you know, photography, something you care about too. And they care about the aesthetics as much as the quality of the writing and everything. So it really was a matter of how to organize it. And it came down to that concept of, you go from the store and then you go into your kitchen. Let's organize it that way. And so that's why there's those four sections. You go from the store to how to organize your pantry to how to pick up a knife to actually the cooking part.
So, I mean, you went to school in Paris at Le Cordon Bleu.
Yes.
Is this how you were taught as well?
No. Cordon Bleu is a really, okay. Well, now that name is like, I don't know where it's like the Starbucks of culinary schools now. So there's, I don't know what the program is like on the state side, but Cordon Bleu Paris is the original. You know, it's where Julia Child learned to cook. And I don't know what that was, my accent for Julia Child for an American
we'll
from Pasadena.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Like
So she, basically, the school hasn't changed. And so you have probably as much space as I have here in this chair to cook. You have one, maybe two burners, and you are shown how to cook something and then have to reproduce it. There is not, I don't even know if there was paper in the school. It was like really hard to take notes. I don't know why. There was no book. There was nothing. And I don't know if that was just French style. You're even graded on the French 20-point system, which I was like, so I'm good at math, but I don't know. Is it good in France to get a 14 or am I sucking? I don't even know what my scores were. But that program was just really interesting. It's more regionally based. So you go from like 19th century French cuisine from the Loire Valley. And then the next semester you move on to something else. And the final semester is when you're like really getting into more current cuisine.
Yeah.
It was dated, you know.
But I mean, it provided you this great foundation to, you know, have a lexicon, have an you know, technique. And
I think what it really provided was this. I felt like there were holes in my skill set from having gone to undergrad in hospitality and management, but not having gone to culinary school. And so I kind of like went reverse. I think if I'd gone to culinary school and that was it, and then I never went to college and hadn't worked that 1,000 hours, then I think I would have felt a little bit short.
So, I mean, with those two sides of the brain working.
Culinary school was horrible. It was really great. It was fun. And I still love it.
I mean, people get different things out of it. It's not to say that, you know, you go there intentionally to be a chef. You go there, like you're saying, you should go there at least to understand that you're going to gain a skill set. And that doesn't necessarily put you in a position.
Well, I knew
you in a profession.
Yeah. And I knew I wanted to go into media. Yeah. I basically, so I worked at Ernst & Young. I would drive to downtown LA I actually worked between New York and LA offices. I would drive to downtown LA and I realized one day when I got a Bon Appetit magazine and opened the front cover that their offices were two blocks from my apartment. So then I started realizing I'd be sitting at this light on San Vicente in Wilshire. And I'd be like looking up at their offices and daydreaming and realized I needed to switch jobs. Yeah. And so I went to culinary school to get into media because I knew I wanted to work in a test kitchen. And I knew that you had to have that had to be your pedigree.
Yeah. So, I mean, you chow.com, you had Escaida on the Food Network,
yeah.
Food Crafters on Cooking Channel.
Yeah.
how did you present yourself? I mean, what were you trying to, you know, relay onto the audience that you've learned in your past?
You know, that all kind of, things kind of just happen. They like unraveled as little steps, and I was really fortunate. So I don't know if I really thought of it that way. I've always thought I have that mentality of being on an editorial team, and it's really that team mentality. Like I go that way with all of my food, all my cooking and everything. And so when I was put in front of camera and, started cooking on TV, I still wanted to collude with people. I still wanted to hold their hand. And so it really comes down to that for me. I think you eat three times a day, you might as well make it interesting. And I always say to people that every time you go to the store, every time you pick up a menu, you have an opportunity to try something you've never tried before. You have something, you know, it's like there's really endless possibilities.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what I really wanted to communicate. And that's why sometimes on Food Network, people would say, I don't get what your cooking is. It's you're not Italian like Giada. You're not Southwestern like Bobby. And I'm like, no, I'm this new generation that's eclectic, but it's based in Whole Foods. And the concept is to kind of just keep it fun.
Yeah. West Coast eclectic.
West Coast eclectic. Yeah,
we'll define that term. You coined it too, right?
No, somebody coined it for me, actually. I think it was Sarah Desser on it. 7x7. I think that's where she was when she said it. So she kind of said that to me. She was like, you know, I think that's what this generation is it's this melting pot 2.0 or 3.0, whatever we are now, where it's our whole generation grew up eating everybody else's food. I mean, I always say to people, like, I went to this high school in LA where my best friends were all first generation of different places from all over the world, like Persian and Japanese and I don't know, everywhere, seriously everywhere. And as a result, I ate all that food. And so it's that concept of like, it's not going to eat ethnic food. It's not going down to like to Thai town just to go eat noodles at night. It's like, it's everywhere all the time. And that's what you understand.
It's like cooking without borders.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wasn't that a show? What was that?
Quite possibly.
I just
yes, can't stand the term melting pot anymore.
I don't like it.
Because that feels like throwing everything in there and letting, you know, the shit boil out of it.
Yeah.
And it's just becoming crap.
Well, you know, so I spent a good amount of time over in Hawaii, and that place is finally getting off its feet in terms of cuisine. Our generation is like really taking the reins in the kitchens over there, which is super cool to see. And the thing they care the most about is exactly that, is saying, it's not just throwing everything in there and just letting shit boil. It's like you actually have to figure out why you want to combine this with that. And so they won't say pack rim. They won't say melting pot. They won't say any of that stuff either because of that. And I think that's just what we're doing in our generation, is we're saying, I just want flavors that go together. And it doesn't have to be like Persian with Italian with the Southeast Asian food. I like these flavors.
It's being bold, but respecting that inherent ingredient.
And
I think you've shown that throughout your career that you do care about that. And Food Crafters is also an excellent example, because you're going there and picking out, you know, singular objects and
ingredients,
people.
Right.
Who were some of your favorite interviewees?
Jeez, Food Crafters is so much fun.
Yeah.
I kind of wish I could like live Food Crafters every day.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how much fun it was. Seriously, my crew was amazing. There were like three of us. We became family. Food Crafters is a hard one. People always ask me what my favorite was, and it's just really hard to say. Well,
How about New York in general? What around here do you remember?
The Little Bit Girls were a ton of fun. We had so much fun the day, and it was blazing hot, and I'd never been to Bed-Stuy before, and I swear we had a call cut 50,000 times because there was like an ambulance going by every 2 seconds because it's Bed-Stuy. But they were just a ton of fun. And I think they do that. They have so much fun with their ingredients, and it just comes out in their personalities and in the kitchen. So that was a good time. And then I'd say my absolute favorite New York, though, is Mother-in-Law Kimchi. Lauren's mom flew out from the West Coast. I had gone to her family's restaurant when I was growing up, eating Korean food there. And her mom came in, and it was, again, so hot that her mom would hang out in the walk-in. It's to the extent that we couldn't get her to come out while we were actually rolling on camera. And she's making the kimchi with these Hello Kitty apron and hot pink, what a lot of my Korean girlfriends call kimchi gloves. They're like hot pink, so they never stain.
Yeah.
Hot pink elbow length gloves. She's like, I don't know, a septuagenarian. She gets in there and she goes, Aida, I want you to be my daughter. Just come in here and make kimchi. So finally the crew was like, fuck it. We're just going to film this thing in the walk-in. So like a good half of that segment was in there, and it was so hilarious. So much fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I mean, talking about single ingredients, kimchi itself, you know, comprised of a few things, right. But I mean, it's such a specific product, and obviously there's so much care in that product.
Yeah.
How do you translate taking those things and not compromising them in recipes?
You know, I think it just really comes down to thinking about why you're using that ingredient to start with, and making sure that that's still there in the end. You know, going with the kimchi example, it's that complex, fishy, spicy, umami thing that you don't want to lose. So I don't know, you know, it's, I like throwing it in an omelet because just the fat of the egg just carries that flavor. And there you go. It's super simple and it's delicious. That's why it's good in a quesadilla as well. You know, that just bolstering the flavor.
Yeah.
Not messing with it, not muddling it.
Well, I mean, you live partially in LA right now, and
yeah.
Roy Choi, you know, brought kimchi tacos to the forefront.
Yeah.
So just seeing those examples you mentioned and him as a prime example, how kimchi has gone, you know, across borders and you know, infiltrated so many different cuisines.
And I think that's what's cool about cuisine right now. It's like we can take these flavors and just completely shift the, you know, the prototype of how you're supposed to serve it. And even if it's taste, I mean, good kimchi stew is still always going to be a good kimchi stew, right? Like that is something.
No
that,
disrespect there.
Absolutely none. Absolutely none. But you know, it's just fun. I mean, I think that's what's nice. It's just not feeling like you're tied into some boundaries of how it's supposed to be or what it's supposed to taste like. I mean, I don't know if you've been to Mission Chinese yet, but I think that's what, you know, Danny does a really nice job with that. And I remember one dish, I don't know if he's serving it. I haven't been to the New York location, so I don't know if he's serving it out here. But one time he came out of the kitchen, he said, okay, I've got this, you know, and the idea is I've spent time in Oklahoma and I want to basically make Peking duck, but pay respect to Oklahoma barbecue. And so he puts it all together on this plate and he's like, got the white bread, sandwich bread with the butter pickles that you would have in the South with Peking duck flavors going on. And you're just like, what the fuck are you doing? This is so good. Why didn't somebody do this before? Yeah, that's what's fun, you know?
Yeah. Usually when I eat at Mission Chinese, I don't talk because I'm just gorging.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just
on the mapo tofu.
Yeah. You know, when I'm those not spicy talking chicken that wings. I'm enjoying myself.
Yeah. It's a good time there. It's fun. And they still play gangster rap out here like they do in San Francisco.
I haven't been to this one yet. But that's like every my time favorite I go to thing. San Francisco, literally I get off the plane and think about calling them for takeout. I'm like, I'll just meet you at 24th Bart, you know. Bring me some beef cheeks.
It's that or papalote for me, actually. Yeah, awesome. Papalote is like my stop through on the way to SFO. You
when
know,
I walk
that
up the
pumpkin.
Hill to Noe sometimes,
I dream about that. Well, were you a chow when we figured out we deconstructed that salsa?
No, but now I'm gonna go back in the archives and
they pumpkin seeds. Excellent. So basically it's like this mole texture going on in a salsa that I still, to this day, I just have to buy it like by the gallon. I could make it, but no, I'd rather buy it.
Well, we're going to take a quick break. And now we know Aida's got chops. We're going to give you the keys to the kitchen when we get right back. You've been listening to The Food Scene on heritageradionetwork.org.
Music for The Food Scene is performed by Cookies. You're listening to heritageradionetwork.org.
Catskill Provisions has Valentine's Day literally in the bag with their Seal the Deal gift bag. Start with chocolate honey truffles, and then move on to breakfast in bed with their traceable organic pancake mix and New York State maple syrup. Sure to satisfy any ardent locavore, check out the Catskill Provisions Seal the Deal package at www.catskillprovisions.com.
Hey, and welcome back to the Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here with Ask Aida. Aida Mollenkamp. And we are going to...
Ask Aida. Great, thanks. Never going to live that one down.
No. I mean, you were like our generation Sarah Moulton.
Yeah, yeah. Thanks. I appreciate that.
I've had Sarah here before, and I'm sure she would respect the hell out of what you were doing, because it's no easy task to kind of feel those questions and, you know, give those kind of answers, you know, pseudo on the fly. I mean, trying to, you know, interpret everyone's crazy.
It was a lot. I think that I had no idea what that concept was until they put me in front of camera. I was like, yeah, it's cool. I'm like, I've done ballet and musicals. I don't know. I can do multiple things at once, pat my belly. And then I got in front of camera and I was like, what the F?
Yeah.
The first day, no, not the first day. The first week I got in front of camera, we're out there on the set, and the producer at the time says, don't you dare call cut. You are talent. Like, gives me this whole talk, right? And just like, I am the producer. I'm the only one on this set who can call cut. So we start putting some oil on the stove. I'm giving my intro, and I can be long-winded sometimes. So long story short, I'm sitting there giving to the camera, and I see out of the corner of my eye that this thing's starting to blaze. I mean, we've got like 3-foot flames coming out of the saute pan, and I'm like, she said not to fucking call cut. I don't know what to do. I hope there's the pyro guy on set. And all of a sudden he's like, cut, what are you doing? Why the fuck didn't you call cut? And I was like, I don't know. She told me not to. I was so scared of her. So yeah, it took a while to figure that one out, but it was fun, you know, because people always thought we were like making up these questions. I was like, no, people are asking us these questions. Oh, yeah. And it's a lot of the same questions. Can I wash a turkey? Like, why is my, I don't know, pickle not turning out correctly or whatever? And it was the same stuff.
Well, I mean, so let's go right into Keys to the Kitchen.
Yeah.
It addresses a lot of those questions.
Yes.
And in a lot more organized manner than 3-foot flames and washing turkeys.
Right.
But, you know, the setup, I think, is one of the smartest parts of this book, because often they say, you know, these are the ingredients, go out and get them. You actually give people a way to understand how to go out and get those ingredients and where to get those ingredients and what to look for.
Right. Well, you know, San Francisco is, I has really made me who I am as a food person. But the one thing I think happened when I was living there full time was I got a little bit myopic about how easy it is to come across really good produce. Food crafters, we were traveling around so much, I kind of woke up to how it can be difficult to find good stuff. And so I wrote the book in Los Angeles mostly, and would challenge myself and go out and take one of my sisters or my friends or somebody with me and see what their problems were. And it just became really evident that 90% of the time they were just not buying stuff that was ripe or in good condition or storing it badly. So I was like, man, if you just read these like first 50 pages of my book, your cooking's gonna be like 19 times better.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping. We'll see. I don't know if that sister ever read this.
Well, she just comes over to your house and you cook for her.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. One sister cooks a lot. That sister, not so much.
Yeah. So, I mean, even simple things like storage, keeping nuts in the freezer. I mean, things that people don't know, or how to preserve herbs, you know, either in compound butters or
oil or I mean, and there's stuff that maybe you've come across, there's stuff that you maybe do a different way, there's more than one way to skin a cat or peel a garlic, right? I just tried to provide it all in one place, because
do you really have skinning a cat in your book?
No, but you know what, there's, you know, that in Joy of Cooking they had like cooking squirrel. I don't know if they do in the current edition. And that's what I said to Chronicles. I was like, you know, I don't want the cooking the squirrel part.
Yeah.
Let's just get away from that and like actually do stuff that people need today in their kitchen. So that was the focus.
Excellent. So part two, how to hone your techniques.
Right.
Amongst that though, are small little tips and techniques that a lot of people don't know, like blooming spices.
Right.
What are some of the other ones that you just took for granted that you realize a lot of people weren't, you know, enacting?
Yeah, that's a good question. Well, I think the big one I was aware of, but I tried to really emphasize, is that people aren't using sharp knives in their kitchen, or they're using the wrong kind of cutting board. And so that's like an uphill battle right there. I think the major one I took for granted, the two major things I took for granted that I came to realize because I was working with my makeup artist on Food Crafters, who is, she cooks quite a bit. She also works on Jada's show. She's a very pretty accomplished home cook. And the two things she never did were she wouldn't heat up her pan. And I was like, it's metal. It needs to expand. Yeah. Like, you aren't going to get this even heat. Like, all these things need to actually physically happen to the metal before you can cook with it well. So she wasn't doing that. And then she wasn't salting or seasoning as she cooked. And it's little things like that that I think if you go to culinary school, if you work in a kitchen, you do take for granted. But then there were things that even my dear friend and recipe tester and food stylist for the book, Lillian King, would come across and when she read it, and she'd be like, oh, I never thought of peeling garlic this way, because different people just do it different ways.
Yeah.
So yeah, I tried to put a lot of that in there. It really came down to providing that and then making sure that the recipes I wrote had the appropriate technique in the front of book. And so I'm sure there are things I could have added, you know, I probably could have added more, but I tried to keep it manageable.
It's pretty chock full.
Yeah. I mean,
there's a lot of information in there, to say the least.
There was a point where I started writing and I was like, oh, I'll get this done really quickly. Yeah. And next thing I knew, I turned in a document that was like 600 pages. And I was like, I've never written that much in my life. I didn't even know it was possible.
Plus photos, plus infographics. I mean, this is chock full.
It crashed my computer, the manuscript. It crashed it three times. And I have like a good Mac. I was like, oh my God, yeah. This document's freaking huge.
Well, I mean, if you get this book, it won't crash your bookshelf. Because it's actually really compact.
Yeah.
Kind of very streamlined too in how it's separated. But going back to, you know, a hot pan and how important that is. I mean, you have a troubleshooting section at the back and you state, you know,
Did you read the whole book? You're incredible.
I'm a little bonkers.
Are you a speed reader?
No, but I'm selective in the right way.
Okay. I'm very impressed.
I mean, something, you know, your food doesn't brown. Why is that?
Right. Yeah.
There it is.
Yeah. It's that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Searing a fish. Right. I mean, the proper way to do that. So it's all relative to having a hot pan.
Right.
And, you know, that's what you have to accomplish so many different things.
Yeah. There are these basic things. The other thing I kept realizing, because my best friend would, I would make zucchini. We have like abundance of zucchini in our CSA in San Francisco when we lived together there. And I'd make it and I'd brown it. Just classic Italian style. Throw some, you know, sweet, sour kind of.
Some agrodolce. Yeah.
Something like that. Throw it aside. And she'd always be like, I can't get my zucchini to get as brown as yours. Finally, I walk in there one day and she's talking on the phone, cooking, and just like moving the zucchini every 2 seconds.
Yeah.
And I was like, why are you moving it so much? She's like, well, I'm cooking. I'm like, cooking does not need to be an action. You can just let the heat do the action work for you.
Patience.
You know? So I think there's little things like that that I don't know. I feel like they sound so basic and so
people don't
dumb,
know.
But some people don't know.
Yeah.
Some people.
The recipes. Yeah. I mean, it'd be wrong of me to ask what your favorite is, because there are so many beautiful recipes.
Thank you.
And fascinating ones too, like the balsamic caramel, you know, roasted chicken, which just is decadent looking.
It is decadent looking. Do you like that photo? Yeah.
Oh, that's
that was a hard photo to get.
Yeah. No, as a photographer, I know how tough that was. So I enjoy it. We all, its like, accomplishment in many reasons.
Big high fives in the photo studio when we got that one that day. You know, the big thing for us was, for me and my team of me and me who worked on that book, I have so many people to thank, including myself. It's really embarrassing. I'm like, everybody's like, so who researched it? Who did this and that? I'm like, oh yeah, that was me on Tuesday and then Wednesday and then Thursday and Friday. The major thing for me with the recipes was, I think that people don't always, this is just the dork math person in me. I don't think people deduce what they're learning when they're cooking sometimes. So I wanted to say, you're learning how to roast a chicken here, and you're actually learning how to dry brine. I love the, you know, Nancy Silver, it's the Zuni technique, you know, Nancy's technique of putting that salt on that chicken just works fabulously. That's what I rely on. The thing though is, I didn't want to just make you a roast chicken. So I put the glaze on there, and the concept is this. You can kind of take the recipe simpler and you can take off the glaze, and then you have a classic roast chicken. Or you can put the glaze on and then you have something a little bit interesting, because it's balsamic, soy, ginger, garlic, and just provides a ton of flavor. Or you can make a variation or a riff on it. So I wanted every recipe to teach a technique. So every single chapter, like the chicken chapter, there's a different style of preparation of chicken, whether it's poaching it or pan roasting it or roasting it, whatever. And then I wanted every single recipe to be either amped up or simplified. And the major thing for me was empowering people. I wanted them to take a recipe, walk away from it and be like, cool, I like it like that, but this is how I'm going to change it. Yeah. And it's funny how there's something about it that, people have already started doing that. And I really have loved seeing it. And it's just simple tweaks, you know,
yeah.
swapping out one ingredient for another.
But fascinating,
or whatever.
At the same time. And you say empowering people to be able to riff on it. These are not traditional recipes to begin with. I mean, starting from the French toast, sandwich. What's in that sandwich again?
It's a hazelnut cocoa spread. You know, I don't want to say Nutella because I hate that stuff.
Yeah.
It's the most disgusting stuff in the world. My French stepbrothers would sit there and do two things when I was little, which grossed me out. And one was they would take Nutella and eat it just right out of the jar, right? And just like keep the spoon in there, open on the counter, like people do with peanut butter. But I don't know. I thought it was disgusting. And then the other thing they'd do is take condensed milk, comes in like a toothpaste tube in France, and they would suck on it, okay? And just like squeeze it into their mouths. So that just these visions of my dorky brother. Okay, I'm totally talking shit about my brothers. But I wanted to put those flavors in there and show you that they can be absolutely delicious and don't have to be crap Nutella.
Yeah.
So every single recipe is a little bit of a switch. I basically figured out where I'd been traveling recently, and I'd been to Lebanon, Sweden, and India right before then. I wish I traveled that exotically all the time. It just happened to all happen within the 18 months right before I worked on the book. And so those really heavily influenced me. The spices and everything.
The Indian burritos. They're a prime example.
Yeah.
I mean, I love a kati roll.
Right.
And for introducing people into what a kati roll is, this is ingenious.
Thank you.
Can you tell people what that recipe is about?
Yeah, it's like, it's super simplified. I think East Coaster, well, New Yorkers probably are pretty familiar with a kati roll. I don't see it as often on the West Coast for whatever reason. And I remember my friend, we were in India for a friend's wedding, and my friend from Poughkeepsie who went to college with me was with me. And you can imagine this like Rambo-esque dude with a puffy vest on and full bandana the whole time. We're going with a thick New York accent running around telling everybody like it is. And he just wanted kati roll everywhere we went. So it was kind of my nod to him, but I want to simplify it and also give you the ability to take those ingredients and change it. So it's curried cauliflower, and you could make that a side dish, or you could just, you know, put that into a pilaf or do whatever you want with it. Or you could just turn it into a burrito. And it's also that nod to the fact that it's, I don't know, there's certain things like pizza or burrito or taco that you can kind of almost put anything in there and it tastes delicious. But I also didn't want to bastardize the fact that the kati roll is a real true thing in India and, fuck with it too much.
Yeah. Well, let's take two soups as a prime example of this. You didn't bastardize either. You gave a quick root to one and a slight iteration to another. Tomato soup with orange.
Right.
That little bit of orange juice kind of changes.
It does.
And the grilled cheese croutons completely changes that recipe into its own.
Thank you.
And then the fobo, the fofa.
Fofa.
Fofa bo. But like the cheat sheet, pho.
Yeah. Because it's funny, every single recipe is actually related to a friend, an experience. I didn't really realize this until we started talking about them like this. Thank you for making me realize this.
Tearing up a bit.
The tomato soup, there were certain recipes that Chronicle just really wanted me to have in the book. You know, I had to have a meatball, a meatloaf, a tomato soup. And I just was like, F it. These are the most boring things in the world to me. I grew up in a family who had meatloaf all the time, and my mom's was fine. Yeah. Like, I just didn't want to put them in the book. So I had to change it a little bit. So my concept is this: I take a recipe and I try to take something you're familiar with and turn it on its head just enough so it's maybe a little bit more just a little more interesting than it might always be out of the can with the Campbells. Or I try to take something that you're not so familiar with. A lot of people don't use coriander and cardamom in all the different savory and sweet ways that you can. So I wanted to introduce that in the book and give you preparations that were simple enough that you wouldn't feel like, I don't know, you're taking too much of a risk. And then the faux pho came about because because my boyfriend just eats so much fucking pho. And I was like, you are just like a MSG boy. You need to get that out of your system. And
plus,
so I started making it.
It takes forever to really make.
It takes forever to really make it. And I was like, all my friends love it. Right, they all go, but none of them make it from scratch, and they're not going to go get the knuckle, all these cuts and stuff. And so I was like, you know, let's get that flavor, make it simpler. And I don't know, a couple of my friends who've made it are happy with the results. You know, it's never going to be exactly the same thing, but that's why it's faux pho.
Well, I mean, you having that relationship with people, which inflects itself in the recipes. I must say that the cornflakes on the chicken is such a throwback to my grandma.
Right.
And she always had cornflakes on top of the fridge, and we were never allowed to eat them for breakfast because they were for chicken only.
I love it.
Yeah. That's just an amazing kind of.
Yeah, but I was having a hard time with cornflake chicken because a lot of times it doesn't, just by itself, it doesn't give you enough crunch.
Yeah.
So that's why there's, you know, a breading that's kind of multi-layered. Because the major thing I kept realizing as I worked with my friends, I did this like 30-question questionnaire for my friends to see what they did and didn't want in a book like this. And the major thing I kept seeing is they were missing texture in their food.
Yeah.
So things like that, I was really wanting to make sure if it was crunchy, it was really effing crunchy.
And you talk about that at the end, you know, about having textures. And flavor boosters too, which I don't want to miss out on talking about, because these very simple things add so much to a recipe. And you go the gamut with infused oils, garnishes, dips, vinaigrettes, and I love the date vinaigrette because I think dates should be in a lot more recipes these days.
I think they're going to be.
Yeah. I'm dates hoping.
Dates of the future.
I'm saying this now.
Yeah.
Salsas, compound butters, rubs, marinades. The beer, lemon marinade.
Yeah.
I mean, that's such a gateway to mojo.
Yes,
I mean, it's
it is. Yeah.
Kind of awesome.
Exactly. It was things like that I wanted to just be like, here's flavor ideas. And, you know, I also, I don't know if you saw this, I have this like weird matrix that explains to you complementary and contrasting flavors. And I think that's really a nod to the Dorenbergs and the work that they do, because their books talk so much about pairing flavor, what to eat with what you drink, and all those books. And I wanted to bring that to the home cook because, I mean, every chef I know relies on those books. It's helpful to know what does and doesn't work with flavors, and I wanted to provide that for people. Because I think sometimes you'll sit there and this happens all the time with one of my sisters. She'll cook, she'll call me up, she's explaining to me what happened. And I'm like, you're missing the arc of flavor. You have the sweet, you don't have the salty, right? You have the sweet, you don't have the bitter, whatever it is. And there's a reason we have those terms, bittersweet and sweet sour and all that, because they really truly do complement each other. And I think sometimes that gets a little bit lost in translation for home cooks.
Well, I think what you're giving with this book is the arc of the kitchen. So, you know, you're showing all acts in, you know, part one, part two, part three. It feels like a complete story.
Thank you.
And
there are no cocktails, though. Or small bites.
Oh, because you have to have your next
keys
book.
Keys to the cocktail.
Yeah. Well, we've run out of time today, and I'm going to wait for that boozy book.
Okay.
That better be coming out soon. Aida, thank you so much for being
on. Thank you.
And look forward to cooking my way through Keys to the Kitchen.
Thank you.
You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Hope to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.